The chamber beyond the door was lit by a pale green glow. Stacked around the walls, each on its own marble shelf, were tier upon tier of coffins. In the centre of the room was a stone chair on a raised dais, and it contained a slumped figure which didn't move, but said in a brittle old voice,
"Come in, young man."
Two Flowers stepped forward.
"I'm dead, you know,"
came a voice from what Two Flower fervently hoped was a head, in conversational tones.
"I expect you can tell."
Said Two Flower.
"Obvious, isn't it?"
agreed the voice.
"You'd be Two Flower, wouldn't you? That's a fine-looking dragon, by the way."
"It is rather good. It just turned up," said Two Flower.
"It turned up," said the voice. "You summoned it?"
"Yes. Well, all I did..."
"You have the power."
"All I did was think of it."
"That's what the power is. Have I already told you that I am Grisha the First? Anyway, yes, the power. It summons dragons, you know."
"But how does it? I've been thinking about dragons all my life, but this is the first time one's turned up."
"Ah, well, you see, the truth of the matter is that dragons have never existed as you, and until I was poisoned some 3 months ago, I understand existence. I'm talking about the true dragon, Draconis Nobilis, you understand. The true dragon is a creature of such refinement of spirit that they can only take on form in this world if they are conceived by the most skilled imagination.
And even then, the said imagination must be in some place heavily impregnated with magic, which helps to weaken the walls between the world of the seen and unseen.
Then the dragons pop through. When I was alive, I could imagine up to 500 dragons at a time. Now, Eliezer, the most skilled of my children, can barely imagine 50 rather nondescript creatures. So much for progressive education. Now yours is almost as good as some of mine used to be. A sight for sore eyes, not that I have any to speak of now."
Two Flower said hurriedly, "You keep saying you're dead."
"Well?"
"Well, the dead, they, you know, don't talk much, as a rule."
"My daughter poisoned me, of course. It is the generally accepted method of succession in our family, but..."
The corpse sighed.
"It soon became obvious that none of my 3 children is sufficiently powerful to wrest the lordship of the Wirrenberg from the other 2. A most unsatisfactory arrangement. So I resolved to remain alive, in an unofficial capacity, which of course annoys them immensely. So it was one of them that kidnapped us. Eliezer, my daughter, her power is strongest, you know. My son's dragons are incapable of flying more than a few miles before they fade."
"Fade? I did notice that we could see through the one that brought us here," said Two Flower. "I thought that was a bit odd."
"Of course," said Grisha. "The power only works near the Wirrenberg. As the dragons fly further away, they begin to dwindle. But I can see I mustn't keep you. I expect you'll be wanting to rescue your friend."
"Hrun?"
"Not him, the skinny wizard. My son Leuk is trying to hack him to pieces."
"Where is he?"
"Just follow the pathway in the dust."
Two Flower ran along the tunnels, with the dragon loping along easily behind him. But soon he was leaning against a pillar, completely out of breath.
"Why don't you fly?"
said Nine Reeds inside his head. The dragon spread its wings and gave an experimental flap. Two Flower stared for a moment, then clambered quickly onto the beast's neck. Soon they were airborne, the dragon skimming along easily a few feet from the floor and leaving a billowing cloud of dust in its wake. A sharp turn sent them soaring out of a tunnel mouth in the side of a vast cavern. There were rocks far below, and up above were broad shafts of light from great holes near the roof. A lot of activity on the ceiling, too. As Nine Reeds hovered, Two Flower peered up. One of the shapes far above detached itself from the roof and began to grow larger. Rincewind was dropping to the distant guano-speckled rocks. His brain reeled with the thought. The words of the spell picked just that moment to surface from the depths of his mind, as they always did in times of crisis. "Why not Seus?" they seemed to urge. "What have you got to lose?" Rincewind waved a hand in the gathering slipstream. "Ashonai!" he called. "Eberis!" he intoned. "Urshuring vandi pithan ungarad feringamali!" As the words blazed their rainbow colours around him, he flung his hands back and prepared to say the eighth and final word that would appear in coruscating octarine and seal the spell. Then the breath was knocked out of him. A pair of arms locked around his waist, and the whole world jerked sideways as the dragon rose out of its long dive. Twoflower laughed triumphantly. "Got him!" And the dragon, curving gracefully at the top of his flight, gave a lazy flip of his wings and soared through the cave mouth into the morning air. In a wide green meadow on the lush tablelands that was the top of the Wirrenberg, the dragons and their riders formed a wide circle. They were all watching the figures clustered in the centre of the grassy arena. The group contained a number of senior dragon lords, and among them were Leuk and his brother Liartes. Slightly to one side stood Eliezer and Hrun. Between the two factions stood the Wirrenberg's hereditary lawmaster.
"I challenge you," said Hrun, glaring at the brothers, "both at once."
Leuk and Eliartes exchanged looks. Leuk scowled. "You arrogant barbarian." The lawmaster put out a blue-veined hand. "As the challenged parties, my lords Leuk and Eliartes have choice of weapons."
"Dragons,"
they said together. Hrun stepped back, shaking his head.
"Oh, no," he said. "I'd rather be dead than fight on one of those things."
"Die, then," said the lawmaster.
Hrun turned to Eliezer.
"Don't I even get a sword?" he pleaded. "A knife, even?"
"No," she said. "I'm sorry."
"You're sorry?"
A boom of wings made Hrun spin around. Leuk's dragon was already airborne. As it swooped low over the turf, a billow of flame shot from its mouth, scoring a black streak across the grass that rushed towards Hrun. At the last minute, he pushed Eliezer aside and felt the wild pain of the flame as he dived for safety. He rolled as he hit the ground and flipped onto his feet again. The other dragon came in from one side, and Hrun was forced to take a standing jump to escape the flame. Leuk came in for a second run, but slower this time to allow for the big man's unexpected agility. As the ground drifted up, he saw the barbarian standing stock still, chest heaving, arms hanging loosely by his sides, an easy target. As his dragon swooped away, Leuk turned his head, expecting to see a dreadfully big cinder. There was nothing there. Puzzled, Leuk turned back. Hrun, heaving himself over the dragon's shoulder scales with one hand and beating out his flaming hair with the other, presented himself to his view. Leuk's hand flew to his dagger, but pain had sharpened Hrun's excellent reflexes to needlepoint. A backhand blow hammered into the dragon lord's wrist, sending the dagger arcing away towards the ground, and another caught the man full on the chin. The dragon was only a few yards above the grass. This turned out to be fortunate, because at the moment Leuk lost consciousness, the dragon winked out of existence. Eliezer hurried across the grass and helped Hrun stagger to his feet. Leuk went on sleeping soundly.
"That was really fantastic," she said. "One down, one to go."
"Yeah, but what happened?"
"The dragons."
"Yeah?"
"They're imaginary."
"Like all these imaginary burns on my arm, you mean?"
"Just listen, will you? Unless my brother is conscious, his dragon can't exist.
It's got no pathway through this...
Run! Shouted Harun.
He threw her away from him and flung himself flat on the ground as Eliates' dragon thundered by, leaving another smoking scar across the turf. Harun scrambled to his feet and set off flat out for the woods at the edge of the arena. No dragon would be able to fly through them. It didn't try. Eliates brought his mount in to land on the turf a few yards away and dismounted casually. The dragon folded its wings.
"I can burn you out," said Eliates after a while.
The bushes remained motionless.
"Perhaps you're in that holly bush over there."
The holly bush became a waxy ball of flame.
"I'm sure I can see movement in those ferns."
The ferns became mere skeletons of white ash. The dragon continued through the spinney, incinerating every likely-looking bush and clump of ferns. Eliates waited. Harun dropped from a tree and landed running, a dead branch in his hands. Eliates' sword came up wickedly to be caught on the branch. Then Harun cannoned into him, and the two men sprawled on the ground. The dragon roared and crashed through the bushes as it tried to turn around. Eliates screamed as Harun brought a knee upwards with anatomical precision, but managed a wild blow that rebroke the barbarian's nose for him. Harun scrambled to his feet, to find himself looking up into the wild horse face of the dragon, its nostrils distended. He lashed out with a foot and caught Eliates, who was trying to stand up, on the side of his head. The man slumped. The dragon vanished. Harun slung the unconscious dragon lord over his shoulder and set off at a trot back to the arena. Halfway there, he found Liuk still sprawled on the ground. He stooped, and with a grunt, hoisted the man onto his vacant shoulder. Eliezer and the lawmaster were waiting on a raised dais at one end of the meadow.
"Kill them," she said.
"Killing unconscious people isn't right,"
Eliezer snorted.
"Then I shall banish them," she said. "Will that satisfy you?"
"Yes."
Harun looked around.
"Where's the next test, then?"
"I warn you that it is perilous. If you pass, however, you will become Lord of the Wurmberg and my husband."
"Am I to be weaponless again?" said Harun.
Eliezer reached up and removed her helmet, letting the coils of red hair tumble out. Then she unfastened the brooch of her robe. Underneath, she was naked. As Harun's gaze swept over her, his mind began to operation two notional counting machines. One assessed the gold in her bangles, the other was plugged straight into his libido. Both produced tallies that pleased him mightily. As she raised a hand and proffered a glass of wine, she smiled and said,
"I think not."
"He didn't attempt to rescue you," Rincewind pointed out. He clung desperately to Two Flowers' waist as the dragon circled slowly, tilting the world at a dangerous angle. In front of them, the Wurmberg hung against the sky.
"What can you see?" said Two Flower to the dragon.
"I see fighting on the top of the mountain,"
came the gentle reply.
"See," said Two Flower, "Harun's probably fighting for his life at this very moment."
"The man you seek is talking to the dragon woman," said the dragon.
"I hope we're in time. Dive now. Go low," ordered Two Flower.
"I think not," said Eliezer.
Harun took the wine cup slowly. He grinned like a pumpkin. Then something like a green blur flashed across the arena, and Harun was gone. The wine cup hung momentarily in the air, then crashed down the steps. In the instant of enfolding Harun gently in his claws, Ninereads the dragon had momentarily synchronized their bodily rhythms. The effect of this was to instantly transform a stationary and priapic Harun into a Harun moving sideways at 80 miles an hour with no ill effects whatsoever. Another effect was to cause Eliezer to scream with rage and summon her dragon. She leapt astride it, still naked, and snatched a crossbow from one of the guards. Then she was airborne, while the other dragon riders swarmed towards their own beasts.
"You clowns!" screamed Harun from his perch on Nine Reed's foreclaws.
"What did he say?"
roared Rincewind, as the dragon ripped its way through the air in the race for the heights.
"Didn't hear!"
bellowed Twoflower, his voice torn away by the gale. As the dragon banked slightly, he looked down. Far, far below, the shore of the Circle Sea stretched like a silver ribbon. Craning his neck, he squinted at the Wirrenberg, and saw the swarm of creatures rising in pursuit. Nine Reed's wings pounded and flicked the air away contemptuously. Thinner air, too. Twoflower's ear popped for the third time.
"I could have been a lord, and you clowns had to go and..."
Harun gasped as the chill, thin air drew the life even out of his mighty chest.
"What's happening to the air?"
muttered Rincewind. Blue lights appeared in front of his eyes. Said Twoflower, and passed out. The dragon vanished. For a few seconds, the three men continued upwards, Twoflower and the wizard presenting an odd picture as they sat one in front of the other with their legs astride something that wasn't there. Then what passed for gravity on the disc recovered from the surprise and claimed them. At that moment, Eliezer's dragon flashed by, and Harun landed heavily across its neck. Eliezer leant over and kissed him. This detail was lost to Rincewind as he dropped away with his arms still clasped around Twoflower's waist. The whole world was coming up towards them like a giant custard pie.
"Wake up!" he shouted. "Dragons! Think of dragons!"
No answer came from Twoflower.
"Dragons!"
thought Rincewind in a panic. He tried to concentrate his mind, tried to envisage a really lifelike dragon. But nothing happened. Clutching the inert Twoflower around the waist, Rincewind plunged towards the disc sea several hundred feet below. The cold waters roared up at him and sucked him down into their green embrace. A moment later, there was another splash as the luggage also hit the water, which gives a further indication, if one were needed, of just how resourceful Sapient Pearwood is. Later on, they used it as a raft. Close to the edge. It had been a long time in the making. Now it was almost completed, and the slaves hacked away at the last clay remnants of the mantle. The arch-astronomer of Krul motioned lightly with his hand, and his bearers set the throne down in the shadow of the hull. "Like a fish," he thought. "A great flying fish. And of what seas? A fish that could swim through the seas of space that lie between the worlds."
"Are the Chelonauts ready?" the arch-astronomer asked. The master launch controller bustled forward.
"Indeed, Your Prominence," he said.
"How long to the doorway?"
"The launch window," corrected the master launch controller carefully. 3 days, Your Prominence. Great Atuin's tail will be in an unmatched position."
"Then all that remains," concluded the arch-astronomer, "is to find the appropriate sacrifices."
"If only you could navigate! If only you could steer!"
A wave washed over the deck. Rincewind and Twoflower looked at each other.
"I don't see how it's my fault," Twoflower said. "You were supposed to be on watch," snapped Rincewind.
"I saved us from the slavers, remember?" said Twoflower.
"I'd rather be a slave than a corpse," replied the wizard.
He looked out to sea. There was definitely less horizon than there ought to be.
"Hmm," said Rincewind. "I said we're bound to strike land sooner or later," said Twoflower. "This current must go somewhere."
"Look at the horizon," said Rincewind. Twoflower squinted.
"Looks all right. Admittedly, there seems to be less than there usually is, but that's because of the rim fall," said Rincewind. "We're being carried over the edge of the world."
There was a long silence, broken only by the lapping of the waves as the boat spun slowly in the current. It was already quite strong.
"Would you like something to eat?"
asked Twoflower. He began to rummage through the bundle that he had tied to the rail out of the damp.
"Don't you understand? We're going over the edge, goddammit!"
"I wish I had my picture box," said Two Flower, "but it's back on that slaver ship with the rest of the luggage, and you won't need luggage where we're going," said Rincewind. He stared moodily at a whale that had carelessly strayed into the Rimwood current and was now struggling against it. There was a line of white on the foreshortened horizon, and the wizard fancied he could hear a distant roaring. "What happens after a ship goes over the Rimfall?" asked Two Flower. "Who knows? Well, in that case, perhaps we'll just sail on through space and land on another world." A faraway look came into the little man's eyes. "I'd like that." Rincewind snorted. The sea around them seemed to be getting crowded. Rincewind noticed several tree trunks keeping station with them, and just below the surface, the water was alive with fish of all sorts. He wondered what kind of life it would be, having to keep swimming all the time to stay exactly in the same place. Pretty similar to his own, he decided. He spotted a small green frog which was paddling desperately. He found a paddle and carefully extended it towards the little amphibian, which scrambled onto it gratefully. A moment later, a pair of jaws broke the water and snapped impotently at the spot where it had been swimming. The frog looked up at Rincewind from the cradle of his hands, and then bit him thoughtfully on the thumb. Two Flower giggled. Rincewind tucked the frog away in a pocket and pretended he hadn't heard. The roaring was louder now. A squid, bigger than anything Rincewind had seen before, broke the surface a few hundred yards away and thrashed madly with its tentacles before sinking away. A whole squadron of flying fish tumbled up in a cloud of rainbow-edged droplets, and managed to gain a few yards before dropping back and being swept in an eddy. They were running out of world. Rincewind snatched at the mast as the roaring final end of everything raced towards them. "I must see this," said Two Flower, half falling and half diving towards the prow. Something hard and unyielding smacked into the hull. A wash of cold sea cascaded over the deck. Rincewind was under several feet of boiling green water. He began to scream, and then the world became the deep, clanging, purple colour of fading consciousness. He awoke with his mouth full of burning liquid. Two Flower was looking down at him with an expression of deep concern. Rincewind groaned and sat up. This turned out to be a mistake. The edge of the world was a few feet away. Beyond it, at a level just below that of the lip of the endless Rimfall, was something altogether magical. Some 70 miles away, a dhow with the red sails typical of a freelance slaver drifted aimlessly through the velvety twilight. The crew were clustered on the foredeck. The captain, a thick-set man who wore the elbow turbans typical of a great Neff tribesman, had never before been really frightened. Now he was terrified.
"I can't hear anything," he muttered.
As if in answer, there came a furious pounding from the oar deck below their feet, and the sound of splintering wood. The crewmen drew together fearfully, brandishing axes and torches. They probably wouldn't dare to use them, even if the monster came rushing towards them. Before its terrible nature had been truly understood, several men had attacked it with axes, whereupon it had turned aside from its single-minded searching of the ship, and had either chased them overboard or had eaten them. The captain wasn't quite certain. The thing looked like an ordinary wooden sea chest, a bit larger than usual maybe, but not suspiciously so. It was just that the men who had been drowned overboard had probably been more fortunate than those it had caught. There had been teeth, teeth like white wooden gravestones, and a tongue red as mahogany. This was the last time he rescued drowning men in mysterious circumstances. Slavery was better than sharks, wasn't it? And then they'd escaped in the dinghy, and when his sailors had investigated their big chest, how had they appeared in the middle of an untroubled ocean sitting on a big chest anyway? And it had bit... "Raft's ready, Lord," said the first mate.
"Into the water with it," shouted the captain, "and get aboard, and fire the ship!"
"What the hell is that?" demanded Rincewind.
It is the Rimbo, said a voice immediately behind his left ear.
The voice was accompanied by a gust of cold, fishy breath. Two Flower, he said.
Yes?
If I turn around, what will I see?
His name is Tethys. He says he's a sea troll. This is his boat. He rescued us, explained Two Flower. Will you look round now?
Not just at the moment, thank you. So, why aren't we going over the edge, then? Asked Rincewind with glassy calmness.
Because your boat hit the circumfence, said the voice behind him.
The circumfence?
Yes, it runs along the edge of the world.
Ah, you mean the circumference, said Rincewind. The circumference makes the edge of things.
So does the circumfence, said the troll.
He means this, said Two Flower, pointing. Hubwards of the boat was a rope suspended a few feet above the surface of the white water. The boat was attached to it, moored yet mobile, by a complicated arrangement of pulleys and wheels. They ran along the rope as the unseen rower propelled the craft along the very lip of the rimfall. That explained one mystery. But what supported the rope?
Rincewind peered along its length and saw a stout wooden post sticking up out of the water a few yards ahead. As he watched, the boat neared it and then passed it, the little wheels clacking neatly around it in a groove obviously cut for the purpose. Rincewind also noticed that smaller ropes hung down from the main rope at intervals of a yard or so. Behind him, the sea troll said,
Up ahead is my house. We will talk more when we are there. Now I must row.
Rincewind looked at the Rimbo, which hung in the mists beyond the edge of the world, appearing only at morning and evening, when the light of the disk's little orbiting sun shone past the massive bulk of Great Artuin, the world turtle, and struck the disk's magical field at exactly the right angle. A double rainbow coruscated into being. Close into the lip of the rimfall were the seven lesser colours, sparkling and dancing in the spray of the dying seas. But they were pale in comparison to the wider band that floated beyond them, not deigning to share the same spectrum. It was the king colour, of which all the lesser colours are merely partial and wishy-washy reflections. It was octarine, the colour of magic. It was alive and glowing and vibrant, and it was the undisputed pigment of the imagination, because wherever it appeared, it was a sign that mere matter was a servant of the powers of the magical mind. It was enchantment itself. Rincewind always thought it looked a sort of greenish-purple. After a while, a small speck on the rim of the world resolved itself into an eyot or crag, so perilously perched that the waters of the fall swirled around it at the start of their long drop. A driftwood shanty had been built on it, and Rincewind saw that the top rope of the circumfence climbed over the rocky island on a number of iron stakes and actually passed through the shack by a small round window. A floating stockade had been built out of rough timber on the hubward side of the island. It contained one or two hulks, and quite a large amount of floating wood in the form of planks, baulks, and even whole tree trunks. The boat slid up against a small jetty. The wizard and Two Flower scrambled onto the planking, and for the first time Rincewind saw the troll. Instead of the betentacled monstrosity he'd been expecting, he found himself looking at a rather squat but not particularly ugly old man, apparently composed of water and very little else. The troll was a pleasant translucent blue colour. As Rincewind stared, a small shoal of silvery fish flashed across his chest. Two Flower and Rincewind followed him into the hut. The troll lit a couple of lamps and poured two cups of green liquid from a tall pitcher. In the dim light, he appeared to phosphoresce in the manner of warm seas on velvety summer nights. Rincewind reached for a cup and looked at the green pool shimmering inside it. He drank. His mouth twisted. He whimpered a little. One of his legs came up convulsively and caught him painfully in the chest. Two Flower swirled his own drink thoughtfully while he considered the flavour. Glen Livid, he said. A certain smoky quality.
Piquant? From the western plantations in Raygreed province, yes? May I ask how you came by it?
All things drift into the circumference in time. My job is to recover the flotsam, timber, of course, and ships, barrels of wine, bales of cloth. You.
Light dawned inside Rincewind's head.
It's a net, isn't it? You've got a net right on the edge of the sea.
The circumference,
nodded the troll. Ripples ran across his chest.
The net would have to be very strong, Rincewind said.
It is.
It could be extended for a couple of miles if you found enough rocks and things, said the wizard.
10,000s of miles. I just patrol this league.
That's a third of the way around the disk. Tethys told them about the ancient and wise kingdom of Kurul, which had constructed the circumference several centuries before, and about the 7 navies that patrolled it constantly to keep it in repair and bring its salvage back to Kurul, and about the way in which sailors marooned on the circumference were turned into slaves and usually had their tongues cut out.
I won't be a slave, said Rincewind. I'd jump over the edge first.
Would you, though?
Asked the troll. One blue arm caught the wizard around the waist. A moment later, the troll was striding out of the shack with Rincewind gripped carelessly in one fist. He didn't stop until he came to the rimward edge of the island. Rincewind squealed.
Look,
commanded the troll. Rincewind looked. In front of him was a soft black night whose mist-muted stars glowed peacefully, but his eyes turned downwards, drawn by some irresistible fascination. On either side, 2 glittering curtains of water hurtled towards infinity as the sea swept around the island on its way to the long fall, bathed in the golden underworld light. Huge shadows grew out of that light, like pillars supporting the roof of the universe. 100s of miles below him, the wizard made out the shape of something. The edge of something. The head of an elephant as big as a reasonably sized continent. Below the elephant, Rincewind swallowed and tried not to think. Below the elephant, there was the distant, painful disk of the sun, and sweeping slowly past it was something that for all its city-sized scales, its crater pox, its lunar cragginess, was indubitably a flipper.
Shall I let go? Suggested the troll.
Nah, said Rincewind.
Tethys stepped back and allowed Rincewind to fling himself onto the ground. Twoflower strolled up to the rim and peered over.
Fantastic, he said. If only I had my picture box. What else is down there?
A bell jangled in the darkness. They returned to the hut. Tethys strode across the creaking floor to the complicated devices of levers, strings and bells that was mounted on the circumference's topmost strand where it passed through the hut. The bell rang again and then started to clang away in an odd jerky rhythm for several minutes. The troll stood with his ear pressed close to it. When it stopped, he turned slowly and looked at them with a worried frown.
You're more important than I thought, he said. You're not to wait for the salvage fleet. You're to be collected by a flyer.
He shrugged.
And I hadn't even sent a message that you're here yet. I wonder how...
He picked up a large mallet that hung on a pillar beside the bell and used it to tap out a brief carillon.
That'll be passed from lengthman to lengthman all the way back to Kurul, he said. Marvellous, really, isn't it?
The lens skimming towards the island was perhaps 20 feet across and totally transparent. Sitting around its circumference were a large number of black-robed men, each one strapped securely to the disk by a leather harness, and each one staring down at the waves with an expression so tormented, so agonizing, that the transparent lens seemed to be ringed with gargoyles.
"What is it?" said Twoflower.
"Well, the lens itself would have been created by Fresnel's wonderful concentrator," said Rincewind authoritatively. "Those wizards on it must all be gifted hydrophobes."
"You mean they hate water?" said Twoflower. "They really loathe it. That's what keeps the lens up in the air."
the flyer halted a few yards hubward of the island, throwing up a sheet of spray. It hung there, spinning slowly. A hooded figure standing by the stubby pillar at the exact centre of the lens beckoned to them.
"You'd better wade out," said the troll.
The hooded figure reached down with one hand and released a rope ladder. In its other hand, it held a silver rod, which had about it the unmistakable air of something designed for killing people. Rincewind's first impression was reinforced when the figure raised the stick and waved it carelessly towards the shore. A section of rock vanished, leaving a small grey haze of nothingness.
"That's so you don't think I'm afraid to use it," said the figure.
Rincewind and Twoflower embarked, and under instructions from the hooded commander, strapped themselves down to rings set in the transparent disc.
"If you make the merest suggestion of weaving a spell," said the darkness under the hood, "you die."
"Third quadrant, reconcile. Ninth quadrant, redouble. Forward all."
A wall of water shot into the air behind Rincewind, and the disc rose at a very steep angle and didn't begin level flight until it was a dozen fathoms above the water. Sometime before all this, a couple of little boats, trolling a net for the ferocious free-swimming oysters which abounded in those seas, caught something that dragged both vessels for several miles in a precisely edgewise direction before one captain had the presence of mind to sever the lines.
"Excuse me," Rincewind said.
The hooded figure turned from its contemplation of the distant haze and pulled back its hood, revealing itself to be a most unusually tinted young woman. Her skin was black. Her hair and eyebrows were the colour of moonlight.
What's your name?" Rincewind said. "Marchesa, and I am a wizard of the fifth level."
"I hope you're not proposing to enslave us," said Twoflower.
"Certainly not. Whatever could have given you that idea? Your lives in Kurul will be rich, full, and comfortable."
"Oh, good," said Rincewind.
"Just not very long."
Kurul turned out to be a large island, quite mountainous and heavily wooded. The land sloped gradually up towards the rim, so that the highest point in Kurul, in fact, slightly overhung the edge. Here, the Kurulians had built their major city, also called Kurul. The lens was approaching now along the very lip of the rimfall. The island not only got higher as it neared the edge, it got narrower too, so that the lens was able to remain over water until it was very near the city. The parapet along the edgewise cliff was dotted with gantries projecting into nothingness. The lens glided smoothly towards one of them, and docked with it as smoothly as a boat might glide up to a quay. Four guards, with the same moonlight hair and night-black faces as Marchesa, were waiting. The guards and their prisoners set off briskly along a lane that wound downwards into what turned out to be a palace of some sort, half-hewn out of the rock of the cliff itself. Rincewind was aware of brightly lit tunnels and courtyards open to the distant sky. He didn't have much time to reflect on all this before a door was opened ahead of them and they were pushed into a room. Then the door slammed behind them.
"Gosh," said Twoflower.
"This is a prison cell?" wondered Rincewind. In the centre of the room was a long, gleaming table laden with food. Most were fish dishes, including the biggest lobster Rincewind had ever seen. He reached out cautiously and picked up some sort of purple fruit crusted with green crystals.
"Candied sea urchin," said a cracked, cheerful voice behind him. "A great delicacy."
An old man had stepped out from behind the heavy curtains. He was tall, thin, and looked almost benign compared to some of the faces Rincewind had seen recently.
"My name is Gahatra. I am the guest master. It is my pleasant task to make sure that your stay here is as delightful as possible."
Twoflower frowned.
"I think I've missed something along the way," he said.
First, we were told we were going to be slaves, and then we were rescued at great magical expense, but then we're threatened, manhandled by guards, and thrown in here, where there's all this food and a man saying he's devoting his life to making us happy. What I'm getting at is this sort of lack of consistency.
Garhatra held up his hands.
"Please, please," he protested. "We certainly do not want to enslave you. Please be reassured on that score."
"Well, fine," said Rincewind.
"You will, in fact, be sacrificed."
"Sacrificed? You're going to kill us?"
"Of course. It would hardly be a sacrifice if we didn't. But don't worry. It'll be comparatively painless."
"Compared to what?" said Rincewind. He picked up a tall green bottle that was full of sea grape jellyfish wine and hurled it hard at the guest master, who flung up a hand. There was a crackle of octarine flame from his fingers. The flung bottle slowed and then stopped in mid-air, rotating gently. At the same time, an invisible force picked Rincewind up and hurled him down the length of the room, pinning him awkwardly halfway up the far wall. He hung there, with his mouth open.
"I didn't enjoy doing that, you know," Garhatra said.
"I could tell," muttered Rincewind.
"But what do you want to sacrifice us for?" asked Twoflower. "You hardly know us."
"You were specified. I don't know a lot about the god in question, but he was quite clear on that point. Look, I must be running along now. So much to organize, you know how it is."
He shut the door behind him. A brief octarine flicker of balefire around it suggested that it had now been sealed beyond the skills of any earthly locksmith.
Gling, clang, tang went the bells along the circumfence in the moonlit rimful roaring night. Turton, length man of the 45th length, leant out of his hut and stared into the darkness. Something was coming along the fence, in giant loping bounds that covered meters at a time. It looked up at him, and for a moment Turton saw something rectangular, multi-legged, shaggy with seaweed, and very angry indeed.
"When are you coming down?" asked Twoflower.
Rincewind snarled.
Meanwhile, the flung bottle hung supportless in the air a few yards away. In its case, time had, well, not actually been stopped, but it had been slowed by several orders of magnitude.
Rincewind sighed.
"Don't you ever worry," he demanded petulantly. "Here we are, going to be sacrificed, and you just sit there eating barnacle canopies."
"I expect something will turn up," said Twoflower.
"It's not as if we know why we're going to be killed," the wizard complained.
"You'd like to, would you?"
"Did you say that?" asked Rincewind.
"Say what?"
"You're hearing things,"
said the voice in Rincewind's head.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
Twoflower gave him a worried look.
"I'm Twoflower, surely you remember."
The spell pinning Rincewind to the wall vanished with a faint pop. He fell forward and landed in a heap on the floor.
"Careful, you nearly squashed me."
Rincewind struggled to his elbows and reached into the pocket of his robe. When he withdrew his hand, the green frog was sitting on it, its eyes oddly luminous in the half-light of early morning.
"Put me down on the floor and stand back,"
the frog blinked. The wizard did so. The room darkened. There was a windy roaring sound. Streamers of green, purple and octarine cloud began to spiral rapidly towards the recumbent amphibian, shedding small bolts of lightning as they whirled. Soon the frog was lost in a golden haze which began to elongate upwards, filling the room with a warm yellow light. As suddenly as it had appeared, the magical tornado vanished, and there, occupying the space where the frog had been, was a frog.
"Fantastic," said Rincewind.
The frog gazed at him reproachfully.
"Really amazing," said Rincewind sourly.
"A frog, magically transformed into a frog. Wondrous."
"Turn around," said a voice behind them. It was a soft feminine voice, but it was coming from a spot where there oughtn't to be a voice at all.
Later, Rincewind and Twoflower couldn't quite agree on any single fact about her, except that she had appeared to be beautiful and that she had green eyes. Not the pale green of ordinary eyes, either. These were the green of fresh emeralds, and as iridescent as a dragonfly. "Look," he began. She raised a hand. "You know that if you say my name, I must depart. Surely you recall that I am the one goddess who comes only when not invoked."
Yes, I suppose I do," croaked the wizard. "You're the one they call the lady?"
"Yes."
"Are you a goddess, then?" said Twoflower excitedly. "I've always wanted to meet one."
The lady smiled. "Your friend should introduce us." Rincewind coughed. This is Twoflower, lady. He's a tourist. And Twoflower, this is the lady. Just the lady, right? Nothing else." She was the goddess who must not be named. Those who sought her never found her. Yet she was known to come to the aid of those in greatest need. And then again, sometimes she didn't. She was like that. She didn't like the clicking of rosaries, but was attracted to the sound of dice. Rincewind shook himself mentally.
"Look," he said, "I don't want to sound impatient, but in a few minutes some people are going to come through that door and take us away and kill us."
"Yes," said the lady.
"I suppose you wouldn't tell us why," said Twoflower.
"Yes," said the lady. "The Coruleans intend to launch a bronze vessel over the edge of the disk. Their prime purpose is to learn the sex of Atuin, the world turtle."
"Seems rather pointless," said Rincewind.
"One day, great Atuin may encounter another member of the species Kelis Galactica, somewhere in the vast night in which we move. Will they fight? Will they mate? A little imagination will show you that the sex of great Atuin could be very important."
Rincewind tried not to think of world turtles mating.
"So," continued the goddess, "they intend to launch this ship of space with two voyagers aboard. It will be very dangerous for the travellers, and so, in an attempt to reduce the risks, the arch-astronomer of Kurul has bargained with fate to sacrifice two men at the moment of launch. Fate, in his turn, has agreed to smile on the spaceship."
"And with the sacrifices," said Rincewind.
"Yes."
"I thought fate didn't go in for that sort of bargaining," said Rincewind.
"You two have been thorns in his side for some time. He specified that the sacrifices should be you. He allowed you to escape from the pirates. He allowed you to drift into the circumfence. Fate can be one mean god at times."
"But you can help us," prompted Twoflower.
"You amuse me. I have a sentimental streak. For a little while I rode in the frog's mind, and you rescued me. In return, I can give you one chance. The rest is up to you." She vanished.
"Gosh," said Twoflower after a while, "that's the first time I've ever seen a goddess."
The door swung open. Gahartra entered, holding a wand in front of him. Behind him were two guards, armed with swords.
"Ah," he said, "you're ready, I see."
"Ready," said a voice inside Rincewind's head.
The bottle that the wizard had flung some 8 hours earlier had been hanging in the air, imprisoned by magic in its own personal time field. But during all those hours, the original manner of the spell had been slowly leaking away, until the total magical energy was no longer sufficient to hold it against the universe's own powerful normality field. And when that happened, reality snapped back in a matter of microseconds. The visible sign of this was that the bottle suddenly completed the last part of its parabola and burst against the side of the guest master's head, showering the guards with glass and jellyfish wine. Rincewind grabbed Twoflower's arm, kicked the nearest guard in the groin, and dragged the startled tourist into the corridor. Before the stunned Gahartra had sunk to the floor, his two guests were already pounding across distant flagstones. They scuttled along a corridor and across a courtyard, and soon left the sounds of pursuit behind. Finally, Rincewind picked a safe-looking door, dragged Twoflower inside, and slammed it behind him. Then he leant against it, wheezing horribly.
"All those worlds," said Twoflower. "It's fantastic."
He turned to a complicated astrolabe, in the centre of which was the entire great Aturian elephant disc system wrought in brass and picked out with tiny jewels. Around it, stars and planets wheeled on fine silver wires. It stood beside a table covered with celestial charts.
"Fantastic," he said again.
On the walls around him, constellations made of tiny phosphorescent seed pearls had been picked out on vast tapestries made of jet-black velvet, giving the room's occupants the impression of floating in the interstellar gulf. Rincewind was deeply troubled. What troubled him most of all were the two suits that hung from supports in the centre of the room. They appeared to be made of fine white leather, hung about with straps and brass nozzles. The leggings ended in high, thick-soled boots, and the arms were shoved into big, supple gauntlets. Strangest of all were the big copper helmets that were obviously supposed to fit on heavy collars around the neck of the suits. He turned round and found Twoflower looking at him with a speculative expression.
"No," began Rincewind. Twoflower ignored him.
"The goddess said two men were going to be sent over the edge," he said, his eyes gleaming. "They'd need some kind of protection, The Carulians have solved that problem. These are suits of space armour."
The door opened. Two husky young men stepped into the room. All they were wearing was a pair of woolen pants apiece. They both nodded at the two escapees with no apparent surprise. The taller of the two men sat down on one of the benches in front of the seats. He beckoned to Rincewind and said,
"Jibbeera atil her certain gathering."
It was the first time that Rincewind had ever been addressed in Carulian, and he didn't understand one word of it. The second man looked up from the chart table where he was poring over a map.
"Eh, ye letin, eh?"
he said. Rincewind smiled and nodded and pushed Twoflower in his general direction. With an inward sigh of relief, he saw the tourist pay sudden attention to a big brass telescope that lay on the table.
"Eh, sitting here,"
commanded the seated Chelonaut. Rincewind took one of the big copper helmets from the rack and brought it down on the man's head as hard as he possibly could. The other man took one startled step before Twoflower hit him with the telescope. He crumpled on top of his colleague. Rincewind and Twoflower looked at each other over the carnage.
"All right," snapped Rincewind, aware that he'd lost some kind of contest, but not entirely certain what it was.
"You know, as soon as I saw the suits, I just knew I'd end up wearing one. Don't ask me how I knew. I suppose it was because it was just about the worst possible thing that was likely to happen."
"Well," said Twoflower, his voice muffled as he pulled the top half of a suit over his head, "anything's better than being sacrificed."
At the very edge of the city of Carul was a large semicircular amphitheatre, with seating for several tens of thousands of people. The arena was only semicircular for the very elegant reason that it overlooked the cloud sea that boiled up from the rimfall far below. Every seat was occupied, and the crowd was growing restive. The arch-astronomer beckoned the master launch controller to him.
"How much longer do we have?"
30 minutes, Your Prominence. After that, Carul will have revolved away from Great Atuin's tail, and the potent Voyager will be doomed to spin away into the interterrapine gulf. I have already set the automatic controls, so..."
"All right, all right. The launch must go ahead.
Maintain the watch on the harbour, of course. When the wretched sacrificial victims are caught, I will take a great deal of pleasure in executing them myself."
Yes, Lord.
"What else have you got to say, man?"
The launch controller swallowed. A monster has come out of the sea, and it's attacking the ships in the harbour," he said. "A runner just arrived from there." The ruler of Carul and the Circumfence considered this for a moment, then shrugged. "The sea is full of monsters," he said. The potent Voyager rested in its cradle on top of a wooden tower in the centre of the arena. In front of it, a railway ran down towards the edge, where for the space of a few yards it turned suddenly upwards. There was a fanfare of trumpets at the edge of the arena. The Chelonauts' honour guard appeared, to much cheering from the crowd. Then the white-suited explorers themselves stepped out into the light. It immediately dawned on the arch-astronomer that something was wrong. Heroes always walked in a certain way. They certainly didn't waddle, and one of the Chelonauts was definitely waddling. As the Chelonauts and their guards started to cross the great arena, the arch-astronomer frowned. By the time the party was halfway across the floor, his mind had reached a conclusion. By the time the Chelonauts were standing at the foot of the ladder that led to the ship, the arch-astronomer was on his feet. One of his arms shot out and back, fingers spread dramatically in the traditional spell-casting position, and any passing lip-reader would have recognised the opening words of Vestcake's floating curse. Its final words remained unsaid, however. The arch-astronomer turned in astonishment as a commotion broke out around the big arched entrance to the arena. Guards were running out into the daylight, throwing down their weapons as they scuttled. Something emerged behind them. The something was a low dome of seaweed, moving slowly but with a sinister sense of purpose. One guard stood in its path and hurled his spear, which landed squarely among the weeds. The crowd cheered, then went deathly silent as the dome surged forward and engulfed the man completely. The arch-astronomer quickly spoke the words of one of the most powerful spells in his repertoire, the Infernal Combustion Enigma. Octarine fire spiralled around and between his fingers as he shaped the complex rune of the spell in midair and sent it screaming and trailing blue smoke towards the shape. There was a satisfying explosion, and a gout of flame shot up into the clear morning sky. A cloud concealed the monster for several minutes, and when it cleared, there was a large charred circle on the flagstones, in which a few clumps of kelp and bladderwrack still smouldered, and in the centre of the circle was a perfectly ordinary, if somewhat large, wooden chest. It wasn't even scorched. The chest rose up on dozens of what could only be legs and turned to face the arch-astronomer. It began to move resolutely towards him. He shuddered. "Magicians!" he screamed. "Where are my magicians?" That was the signal for every magician, enchanter and thaumaturgist in Kurul to leap up eagerly and, under the terrified eyes of their master, unleash the first spell that came to each desperate mind. Soon the chest was lost to view again in an expanding cloud of magical particles which billowed out and wreathed it in twisting, disquieting shapes. But none of this in any way prevented the thing at the base of the cloud from moving at a steady walking pace towards the arch-astronomer. Rincewind and Twoflower watched in awe from the shelter of Potent Voyager's launch tower.
"Well," sighed Twoflower at last, "there goes the luggage."
"Don't you believe it," said Rincewind. "Sapient Pearwood is totally impervious to all known forms of magic. It's been constructed to follow you anywhere. I mean, when you die, if you go to heaven, you'll at least have a clean pair of socks in the afterlife. But I don't want to die yet, so let's just get going, shall we?"
"Where?"
"Anywhere that isn't here." Twoflower called to his luggage. It stopped its stolid procession across the tortured flags, turned on its length, and headed towards the Potent Voyager. Rincewind watched it sourly. The luggage had an elemental nature, absolutely no brain, a homicidal attitude towards anything that threatened its master. He wasn't quite sure that its inside occupied the same space-time framework as its outside.
"Not a mark on it," said Twoflower cheerfully,
as the box settled down in front of him. Soldiers were beginning to appear at the edge of the arena. An arrow bounced off the tower behind Twoflower.
"Quick," he said, "into the ship. They won't dare fire at that."
"I knew you were going to suggest that," groaned Rincewind. "I just knew it." A spear arced out of the sky and trembled to a halt in the woodwork by the wizard's ear. He screamed briefly and scrambled up the ladder after Twoflower. Arrows whistled around them as they came out onto the narrow catwalk that led along the spine of the Potent Voyager. Atop the centre of the ship was a large round bronze hatch with hasps around it. Twoflower knelt down and started to work on them. In the heart of the potent Voyager, fine sand had been trickling into a carefully designed cup for several hours. Now the cup was filled by exactly the right amount to dip down and upset a carefully balanced weight. The weight swung away, pulling a pin from an intricate little mechanism. A chain began to move. There was a clonk. "What was that?" said Rincewind.
"What was what?" said Twoflower, busy with a wingnut.
"Thought I heard something," said Rincewind. The ship lurched. Then, with infinite slowness, it began to move along the rails. In that moment of black horror, Rincewind saw that Twoflower had managed to pull the hatch up. A metal ladder inside led